I'm Rachel Bovard.
Josh Hammer.
I'm Emily Jashinsky.
And I'm Ben Weingarten.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. So welcome back, everybody. We have a wide-ranging show for you, as we normally do. But we're going to start with talking about the fallout from Afghanistan. Obviously, that's been dominating the headlines. We'll start there with both Josh and Emily sort of covering that. And then Ben and I are going to discuss two sort of additional topics that get into COVID and corporate America going full Chinese social credit system. So wide-ranging things to discuss today. But with that, we'll kick it off to Josh to start us off.
So thank you, Rachel, and welcome back home from your own international escapades. hope it was a very enjoyable honeymoon. I apologize to the viewers for the inadequate lighting here. I have just moved myself to Florida. Very happy to be in Ron DeSantis' country, not so happy to be in this dimly lit apartment, but we'll rectify that soon. But to get back to the matter at hand here, so the topic of the day is still Afghanistan. The topic of the day has been Afghanistan for the past few weeks. The topic of the day will probably be Afghanistan, at least from my perspective, probably for the foreseeable future until the next, obviously unforeseen, cluster, event kind of, I guess, shoves everything aside. But for now, it's kind of all hands on deck, all eyes glued to the debacle of this just horrifically botched withdrawal, this horrific stain, obviously, I think on the United States of America, obviously on President Biden, perhaps personally more than anyone else here. And I thought it was just good to kind of open this episode by kind of getting us all back up to speed here and kind of covering what has happened in the interlude between our previous recording and this one. Obviously, the biggest and most tragic event of all, of course, was last Thursday's attack at the airport. 13 U.S. servicemen killed in an ISIS K, it's an ISIS affiliate, suicide bombing there. All indications point toward the fact that the Taliban that the Biden administration seems to believe is now kind of a righteous among the nations, almost, if you will. The administration is simultaneously treating the Taliban as if it's a legitimate geopolitical actor, while at the same time, all indications seem to point towards the fact that the Taliban allowed ISIS-K close proximity to the airport, killing 13 U.S. servicemen, Marines, maiming and injuring dozens of hundreds of others, if you include Afghan civilians as well. It was the single bloodiest day in Afghanistan in a decade, if not longer than that. There's so much else to discuss here, obviously. I mean, if you kind of just look at the statements, I mean, Ned Price, State Department spokesman, this was on August 30th, Ned Price tweets out, quote, "The Taliban needs to meet its commitments and obligations in Afghanistan on freedom of travel, respecting basic rights of the people, upholding its commitments on counterterrorism, not carrying out reprisal violence against those who stayed, and forming an inclusive government." An inclusive government. This is the Taliban. I mean, like, to state the obvious here, this is the Taliban. Like, the Taliban is indistinguishable from Hamas, from various other Muslim Brotherhood outfits, from Al-Qaeda, from ISIS. The Taliban, obviously, I feel so silly having to actually say this here. The Taliban literally harbored Al-Qaeda for years, if not decades, in the period leading up to 9/11. Without the Taliban, 9/11 obviously would not have happened here. So they, left and right, this notion that the Biden administration is now purporting to treat the Taliban as at least a quasi-legitimate diplomatic actor on the geopolitical chessboard. And it looks like we're kind of formally evacuating, taking our flag down from the embassy there. So we're not necessarily going to have a formal diplomatic presence, but we're certainly talking about kind of back channel behind the scenes presence here. That's, of course, to say nothing of the fact that we have stranded at least 100 to 200 Americans in Afghanistan. The last military plane, the last military convoy has left. They are out. After 20 years or nearly 20 years of fighting there, but we have left Americans on the ground there. And Jake Sullivan, I think it was on air earlier this week as saying that, yeah, we're gonna have to work with the Taliban. We're effectively gonna have to pay them. We're gonna have to use US taxpayer ransom money to get our remaining 100 to 200 approximately, we don't know the exact number probably, of Americans out of this horrific hellhole Sharia governed tribal backwater that we obviously never should have been in for the past roughly 10 years to begin with. So egg on the face continues. This is a problem for Biden that is not going to go away. Personally, I wonder when House Judiciary Committee folks might start drafting articles of impeachment. From my perspective, all of this is eminently impeachable conduct here. The commander-in-chief prerogative is the most solemn obligation that a president of the United States takes. What is the prerogative of the commander-in-chief, if not to make sure that when you're evacuating from a 20-year war overseas, that you don't strand your own citizens on the ground there? And I guess just the final point to make here, and this is kind of it's been hovering in the background over the past few weeks, and I fear it's an issue that's going to it's going to percolate, and hopefully it won't be an issue, but I certainly think it will be, of course, is that of the so-called refugees. We are taking in thousands of Afghans, interpreters, translators, people who worked with us, all various others of special immigrant visas who kind of get in on various immigration law provisions here. You know, as a lot of folks, Daniel Horowitz, Jordan Schachtel, have done a great job of reminding us, 9/11 was first and foremost an immigration failure, okay? Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, did not launch an intercontinental ballistic missile from the mountainous tribal backwater hellhole of Afghanistan. The suicide bombers were here on visas that we doled out, oftentimes expired visas. You know, that kind of gets us obviously into kind of biometric visa tracking and all sorts of reforms that haven't fully gone into place yet. But we are now willfully by our own volition, by our own kind of purported attempt to seize some sort of faux moralistic high ground, bringing in the very problem here. So a lot to kind of break down. I'm obviously clearly still angry about this, but I'd be curious for anyone else's thoughts on the continued fallout from this debacle.
I mean, in a sane country, and I've said this, I think, a million times on Twitter right now, because I think it just keeps coming back to this for me. In a sane country, the congressional investigations would have started yesterday. In a sane country, you would have had the generals being hauled before Congress to say, you were given a direct order to have a plan for this, not even just by Joe Biden, by Donald Trump. And the lack of preparedness, the failure of our intelligence, the willfully, I just have to think at this point, it was willful misleading about the situation on the ground. There's no accountability for it. And, you know, I think, you know, Emily had a great piece on this in the Federalist recently, where she made the point that it's like both things are true, right? The withdrawal was abominable and I think a point of real shame for the United States. And at the same time, you know, the war has been prosecuted in really, really terrible ways, in ways that were just, you know, our military industrial complex served themselves, and that was about it. I think that's one of the biggest takeaways from the last 20 years. And the fact that nobody, you know, the only person that's been fired was that, you know, poor Marine who had the audacity to speak up against his commanding officer to say, I don't have confidence in you. He's the only person that's been fired. And so I do think that there's layers and layers of failures here that, you know, go beyond just this administration. Although I think it's been appalling the fact that, you know, Joe Biden bears responsibility for these wars beyond just his presidency. I mean, he voted for them. You know, he wanted to carry them out while he was a senator. And so, you know, I think there's just layers and layers of failures that we aren't reckoning with. The people that need to learn this lesson are our military planners, and they've learned nothing. And at this point, you know, in addition to all the tragedy that's unfolded, to me, that's one of our biggest takeaways right now, is there's no policy humility. You know, we're not going to set a new baseline for anything here. And that is a horrific shame on this country. And it's a direct attack, I think, on the sacrifices that have been made by U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan.
I agree. If you wanted to undermine American national security, our interests, our prestige, our citizens to the maximum extent, you could not have done a better job than has been done with respect to this withdrawal. And that alone should rise to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. And of course, impeachment is a political remedy. So it only makes sense that the half of Congress that's supposed to represent us doesn't merit it worth it to raise that political remedy and actually do on behalf of their constituents what they ought to do. And I think to the broader point of the failures, since all of Washington is complicit, left and right, in the failures, that further explains why they don't want to go down the rabbit hole, which they should go down, of impeaching a whole slew of officials related to this. And of course, to your point as well, Biden was vice president. He was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Almost no one in Washington has been more involved with Afghanistan at the highest level than Joe Biden. So that's absolutely true. I'll just make a couple of narrow points. It's amazing. We didn't even talk about the phone call between Biden and Afghan leader, former leader Ghani, in July, where essentially President Biden said, well, things look pretty bad, even though he was telling the world that they didn't look so bad. And we really need to work on the optics here. We need to change the perception. And the direct quote is, I believe, whether it is true or not, we need to project a different message to the world. That was Joe Biden's message in real time in July of this year. People have been impeached for phone calls on far less than that. So I think that alone would be a great point to raise. But the last point I'll make is, and this is really just the withdrawal, the disastrous withdrawal is the cherry on top of a horrific Afghanistan mission right after basically the first month of engagement there. Once you get beyond the initial invasion, take out the targets you want to take out, send a message, et cetera. That should have been it. That should have been the mission. There should have been no reconstruction, rebuilding, et cetera, which turned into a corrupt quagmire that we've seen for two decades. But is it any more perfect than this, characterizing our deep state sort of national security and foreign policy view and the progressive national security and foreign policy view, that we've outsourced American security to a jihadist group par excellence that was the harbor of Al-Qaeda, and we are importing thousands of unvetted Afghan refugees? I don't think anything could better capture the state of our deep state.
And I'll jump in quickly because the next topic is one that I'll start us off with, but I'll just quickly chime in on this topic. And I'm glad we're doing a sort of retrospective since the last time we taped, because the last week has been just deeply tragic. And we have seen more and more mistakes, and we've seen actually more and more clearly broken promises on the president's behalf. As we tape this on Tuesday, the president gave an address on Monday, just last night, that everyone is still sort of internalizing and digesting, wherein he again did not address the broken promises that he's made to people on the ground. He has not addressed his failed predictions. The White House has done, I think, a pretty poor job dancing around the failed predictions. Now every White House is going to spin. That's their job. Jen Psaki and Joe Biden really at this point shouldn't be expected, even if it's the right thing to do, to just come out and say, listen, we messed up. And I'm sorry, by the way, it's Wednesday, not Tuesday. And the president's address was on Tuesday, not Monday. Labor Day week, you know, everything gets messed up. August in DC, everything is the same. What I will say, though, is it's amazing how they have failed to provide any explanation whatsoever for when General Milley comes out and says there was nothing I saw that said the Taliban would complete their takeover in 11 days. How did that happen? And on that point, we can transition to the topic I wanted to discuss, which is also related to this, which is a lot of people that we often find common ground with on this very show, populists on the left, are refusing, I think, to grapple with the scale of Joe Biden's failure here. They're not refusing to grapple with it so much as they're refusing really to acknowledge that Joe Biden, had a pretty massive screw up in this case. And the piece that Rachel mentioned, which I agree was great because I wrote it, but the important point that I wanted to make with a lot of these sort of populist leftists in mind, and some of them are sort of the typical like anti-war leftists who have been vindicated on this issue, as had some of the people who opposed this war in the Middle East on the right initially and were trashed by the likes of David Frum and others. But some of these people that we often find common ground with, I think it's important to say there's nuance here, right? Biden made probably at this point what a lot of us would agree, even if some of us wouldn't, a lot of us would agree it was the right decision. Donald Trump wanted to dial back our engagement in Afghanistan. Both parties have wanted to dial back our engagement in Afghanistan. What that looks like, the scale of it, we can disagree on that. But to defend Joe Biden and to say that he did the best he could in the given situation, it makes no sense to me. And I think it's something that needs to, I want to talk about it with you guys, because I think it's a serious issue in that if we are to cobble together a serious bipartisan coalition against forever wars, against endless wars in which we do spend so much blood and treasure in the backwaters, as Josh accurately says, we need to come on the same page on this issue, and that Joe Biden, it is possible, it is actually possible to disengage from these conflicts without letting them take Bagram, without having horrible intelligence failures without the president just sticking in Camp David for days and leaving our allies wondering what the heck is happening. This was a decision that could have been made without that. And if we accept that it's impossible to disentangle ourselves with some modicum of credibility and stability, then we make those difficult so much harder. You're basically doing the bidding of the neocon propagandists who want us to believe that once you engage, it's impossible to disengage without leaving, you know, a mess in your immediate wake. Would it have been a mess of us getting out no matter what? Yeah, this would have been tragic. Extracting would have been tragic. It's a matter of scale, though, and to accept that it had to be this bad, I think, does a real disservice to the debate or to the argument that we cannot be mired in some of these endless wars. And so with that, I'll open it up to the group.
There's an element of what you said, I think, that's percolating on the right and being abused by the neocons in a way that I think is really destructive that I wanted to bring up here, because, you know, it goes hand in hand with how tragic this withdrawal has been. But there's people on the right, neocons in particular, who are using the 13 dead Americans, which is awful, the Marines that died, they are using that to say, this is why we can't ever end a war. And, you know, they're using their sacrifice to say, you know, this is, you know, why, again, to the point you made, we can't ever withdraw from anything because this will happen. And I personally find that disgusting. I know, you know, there's people on the right that want to own the libs as hard as they can. I get that. But at the end of the day, and I hate to put it this way, if anyone has been paying attention to Afghanistan for the last 20 years, it has been this bad. It has been worse. Afghan civilians have died. Over 2,000 of our soldiers have died. You know, we have spent trillions of blood and treasure in this war. And I think for people to opportunistically on the right claim that the awful and tragic deaths of 13 Marines to prove that this is why we need to go to do more war, I think is sort of the... It's gutter politics, and I see it from the right, and I'm just, my stomach is turned by it. So I really hope that that's, you know, something that at least I will condemn. I don't, you know, I know that we'll probably see it now in attack ads run against Democrats, these 13 soldiers, you know, trotted out from their graves, you know, to hang around their necks as a justification for going in elsewhere. And I think it's wrong.
Let me make a few points briefly, and then I'll turn it over to Josh on this one. The fact that the government, so-called, that we set up fell within hours is a complete indictment of the engagement, the length of the engagement. So I think that alone speaks to the imperative that we ought not to be there spending trillions of dollars and expending all that blood for a complete and utter failure at the end of the day in the final analysis. Second point on Emily's point about kind of the left on this and why they're sort of absolving Biden here. I think the good faith way to look at it is, well, they really like Biden's remarks about why we should be withdrawing. And they think that the positive of that outweighs the negatives of the fact that the withdrawal was done in every single element in the most cataclysmic way possible, objectively, starting with the Bagram decision and probably even before that as well. So I think the good faith way to look at it is, well, they think that sort of the pros outweigh the cons. I don't think that argument has merit. I think the bad faith way is, well, we like someone who's on closer to the left, and thus we're not going to go hard on Joe Biden on this because there's egg on everyone's face. And I do think that there's an element of that as well. And then I do think there's a broader question in terms of the broad coalition that Emily is talking about, in terms of kind of the populace on the left or the actual liberal leftists who are out there of... There's probably a question of whether they thought we should have gone into any country after 9/11. And if so, what the appropriate response would have been, because I think there's questioning of, is the jihadist threat, does the jihadist threat pose as big an issue to the United States as many conservatives believe the jihadist threat did and does today? And that's a much deeper issue and question to be grappled with. How big is the threat? And then what is the proper way to counter it? I would hope that we could all agree that immigration would be the first thing. The first thing is keep jihadists off of your soil in the first place. That would be lesson number one from 9/11. But I do think that there are, of course, many on the left who think that conservatives have just created the Islamist boogeyman and used that to justify a whole slew of bad things. And they're conflating a number of different issues at play. And maybe that's something that we'll grapple with over time on this show.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Ben hit the nail on the head there when he said that the fact that the government, or quote unquote government, in Kabul fell within effectively hours after a nearly 20-year invasion. I mean, if that is not just a searing indictment on the entire hubristic project of democracy exportation to non-Western, especially kind of Sharia governed backwaters, I mean, none of us will probably ever see in our lives as searing an indictment of kind of the broader neoconservative, neoliberal interventionist nation building project than that. And if that's not an eye-opening event, I genuinely do not know what will be, because kind of just the rapidity, the swiftness, the speed with which it happened is something that I pray will obviously never be replicated here. Just a few other quick points. So look, you know, we rightfully condemn kind of like, I guess we would call them right liberal neoconservatives, but there's obviously a lot of kind of left liberals who do this too. I mean, it was really kind of Samantha Power, who was kind of the intellectual progenitor, or at least a chief advocate of this so-called responsibility to protect doctrine. It's kind of a liberal interventionist doctrine, which really was kind of the ideological impetus for us going into Libya in 2011 to topple Muammar Gaddafi. So it's how we arrive at this kind of term, the blob, right? Rachel's used this a lot in her writings and speaking. The blob is kind of this kind of bipartisan cabal, really kind of centered on K Street think tanks. So from like the neoconservative faux right to the neoliberal responsibility to protect left. The egg is on all of their faces, because they collectively across really the entire spectrum are the ones who have been pushing these various sorts of kind of interventionist, humanistic, democracy exportation centric foreign policy doctrines here. And, you know, my segment on the previous podcast was about what kind of like a prudent national interest, America first, whatever you want to call it, middle ground kind of foreign policy might actually look like here. And I don't want to reiterate too many of the same points here, but just to kind of reiterate one, I think, crucial point. The idea is not that the United States should spread itself thin with troops on the ground everywhere. Surely there are some very strategic places. I mean, especially when you consider the fact that the Chinese Communist Party is the leading geopolitical threat to the American way of life and all that we stand for in this century. It probably does make sense to kind of increase our presence in kind of perhaps the Philippines, Taiwan, areas around there and so forth. But in general, the paradigm should not be kind of spreading our troops thin. The paradigm should be to bolster our allies. Diplomatically, legally, in any kind of a probably non kind of crass way possible, to then better enable them to handle kind of strategic regions for themselves where we have shared enemies. So I mentioned on the last episode, the Abraham Accords are kind of like the perfect example of what this looks like in practice here. You bolster a core ally, Israel, a lot of our other allies in the region, UAE, Bahrain, and so forth, see that the United States stands with that one ally, in that case, Israel. Then they make peace, and then that alliance is better suited to tackle the actual threat in the region, which is Iran. There is no compelling reason why that paradigm cannot be replicated and duplicated in other regions around the world. But anyway, for now, I guess, yes, searing indictment of the blob. I am not particularly optimistic the blobsters will learn their lessons, but on this show, at least, we can continue to call them out.
So with that, I think we're going to switch gears a little bit, and Ben's going to talk about our other favorite topic, which is COVID insanity.
And Rachel, I'll just add quickly before jumping into Ben, there's this, as Josh just laid out, there's this notion of Biden as the blob slayer on the populist left and in some corridors of the populist right. And everything that all of us just said, particularly what Josh just said, it's just important for us not to let him off the hook on this, because did he make a decision that undercut the blob? Yes. Does that render the blob correct? Absolutely not. And the more that we give Biden credit for doing it well, which is just a false narrative, the more you actually give some power back to the blob. And so I think it was just important for us to spend some time debunking that the false narrative of Joe Biden as the blob slayer, because it actually doing this as poorly as he did, I think empowered them, as we all just said. And with that, I'll cede.
So I've been working on this comparison out in my mind and on Twitter, probably not prudently for a while, that coronavirus is poised to be the Afghanistan of pandemics in terms of in many respects. And so I wonder if I can figure out a parallel here, but I'll try on the intelligence failure, sort of failure theater side of things. And that is the intro to a story that was completely overshadowed last week, but which has massive geopolitical implications, which is that the intelligence community came back with its 90-day review, vaunted 90-day review of the origins of the coronavirus. And you'll be shocked to know that their non-conclusion was the exact same non-conclusion that they had, that they issued in a press release via the National Intelligence Agency, the DNI, just days after President Biden announced that he was calling for the intelligence community to do the review. So part of the actual review declared, and I'll quote here, that the intelligence community remains divided on the most likely origin of COVID-19. All agencies assess that two hypotheses are plausible: natural exposure to an infected animal and a laboratory associated incident. Here is what DNI put out in a press release, I believe on May 27th of this year. Quote, the U.S. intelligence community does not know exactly where, when, or how the COVID-19 virus was transmitted initially, but has coalesced around two likely scenarios. Either it emerged naturally from human contact with infected animals, or it was a laboratory accident. So thanks to the intelligence community for that profound revelation for the American people. And I actually saw this coming pretty much from the very beginning. The fact that Joe Biden punted this question of the coronavirus origins only after, by the way, originally punting it to the World Health Organization, which we went right back into immediately after Biden became president, in spite of the fact that it's a Chinese Communist Party controlled agency, in effect, if not in actuality. And then only after, of course, lab leaks suddenly became politically correct. And we'll never really know fully why it became politically correct, but for the fact that there were all manner of revelations about the quashing of the Trump State Department's effort to look into the origins. And there were also reporting from prominent science journalists like Nicholas Wade, and then certain prominent doctors as well came out and said, well, actually, this does look like it's pretty viable. And so suddenly there was political pressure on the Biden administration to say and do something about it. But punting to the intelligence community, which of course loves to hedge on questions that have major geopolitical implications. And of course, how could it possibly find smoking guns, proverbial smoking guns, that might've been literally or figuratively buried in China? We're talking, you know, more 18 months plus after the outbreak of the coronavirus. This was obviously going to be the non-conclusion. We don't know essentially, but yeah, lab leak is viable. They did judge the intelligence community that this was not a bioweapon and that Chinese officials had no foreknowledge of what was going to transpire, which it would be really interesting, obviously, to see the raw intelligence behind that. I'm sure we never will. But it's interesting that the intelligence community is very confident in that assessment and not really in anything else. But my point is that this is actually all a sideshow. Is it important to know how the coronavirus originated? Yes. Does that have implications for biosecurity in America and how we react to pandemics going forward? Sure, it does. Does it have implications for the U.S.-China relationship when it comes to medical research? Obviously so, and we should have no ties, probably, when it comes to medical research with any entity relating to mainland China and the Chinese Communist Party. But leaving all that aside, this is a sideshow because once China effectively, in their actions, through their lies, deception, aggression, obfuscation, and beyond, in effect, weaponize the coronavirus against America and the rest of the world, how it originated became of secondary importance. And that is why I argued in an article in the Epoch Times, and I've argued beyond as well, that essentially this intelligence community non-assessment was a sideshow. The real story is that China has not been punished when we know clearly the way it reacted once the coronavirus itself broke out and inflicted cataclysmic damage on the world for months and led us to make all manner of unforced errors where we've committed economic suicide. We've done tremendous cultural destruction. We've destroyed our liberty, undermined justice in our response to it, and well beyond, and essentially live in a different America today than we did at the start of 2020. So this intelligence community report, I argue, is sideshow, and it allows the Biden administration to act as if it cares about coronavirus's origin and China's misbehavior in terms of covering it up without actually doing anything about it, without actually punishing a Chinese Communist Party that should have been punished months ago. It should have been the first act of the Biden administration, quite frankly. And I argue that it's because too many in the US government and our elites, our ruling class more broadly, have a vested interest in not attacking communist China directly. And there is also obviously complicity in the way of the medical journals and medical professionals who themselves poo-pooed the lab leak thesis. There's, of course, our own government funding by proxy of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, where this almost certainly arose, and beyond. So there's so much complicity across so many layers, akin to Afghanistan in that respect, that there's no interest, there's no appetite, clearly, in a Biden administration to prosecute the case against the Chinese Communist Party and actually confront them with real teeth. And this is to say nothing, of course, as I've argued at length before, of Joe Biden's kowtowing to communist China for his nearly 50 years in Washington. Again, the cherry on top here. So with all that, I wonder if folks here agree with my take that this IC review is sort of a sideshow and was exactly the conclusion the Biden administration would have wanted if it didn't want to do anything about communist China's malign efforts with respect to coronavirus.
I mean, I think that's probably right. I have very little faith in the intelligence community, generally speaking. You know, you can link it to Afghanistan or coronavirus. I think it's pretty clear that, and this became very obvious under Donald Trump's administration, that it can be weaponized. You know, the IC can be weaponized and it can be politicized. And if they do fail, which I think is pretty clear with the case of Afghanistan and potentially with coronavirus as well, there will be no consequences. And this is sort of an element of late stage empire that I think we keep coming back to, which is that you can have cataclysmic events like coronavirus, you can have, you know, decades long military failure like in Afghanistan, and nothing changes, right? We are just told that credentialed people made these decisions. And because this person went to Harvard, Yale, and the University of Chicago, sorry, Josh, they cannot be questioned, and their judgment is infallible. Because so much of grappling with COVID and Afghanistan would require admitting that they were wrong. It would require admitting fallibility. And this is especially true with COVID, right? Where especially now when we're living in this environment where, you know, two vaccines weren't enough. Now you have to get a third and a fourth and a fifth, right? Because, you know, the vaccine wasn't perfect to begin with, but they can't admit that. So they're just going to make you keep taking boosters and, you know, shut you down if you ask why. And so again, it just comes back to this idea that where is the accountability gone? Where has the, you know, the search for justice within our government sort of gone? And I don't know how you have a country that, you know, thrives in an atmosphere where no one in the ruling class is ever held accountable, and anyone who questions the regime on anything, is virtually shut down and deplatformed from public life. This is something it's not as optimistic take, but it's something I think about a lot, because I think there's endless examples of this as a hallmark of, again, like a late stage empire that just continues apace without actually improving itself.
And I'll just say generally, I think Ben's point is going to apply to a lot of this administration's China policy, and that it'll be sort of easy to gesture towards undercutting the CCP strategically in various different ways, but to actually watch what happens behind the scenes, or honestly, what doesn't happen. So the way that we were spoken to by the representatives from China in Anchorage is a good example in that it's not as though our representatives didn't say anything that was pro-American. It's that they didn't, you know, give it back, right? Like, they just sort of sat there and took the beating from the Chinese representatives that was, you know, seeking to undercut America's credibility. And the pushback just wasn't sufficient. And so I think you can expect to see some gesturing, but a lot of it will be empty. And that's just a trend that I would generally pay attention to when it comes to this administration, because, you know, not taking steps that will really meaningfully curb China's power might be the most pro-China thing that they actually end up doing.
Yeah, I have very little to add here. I do think Ben's assessment is all but assuredly correct. The only thing that I'll add is we talk a lot on the show, obviously, about the chasm between the ruling class and the deplorables, you know, that seems to grow, frankly, by the day, and manifests itself in a number of ways. There's obviously kind of the meritocracy complex in higher education. Bit of a shameless plug for my other podcast, my Newsweek's Debate podcast. We actually just did an episode on higher education, kind of getting into these class issues. So go check that out. But obviously, the intelligence community and Fauci as well, and the public health bureaucracy are kind of front and center of this entire debate here. And I guess the only thing that I'll add when we're talking about punishing China, I did a column on this, I don't know, I can't even keep track at this point, maybe 2 or 3 months ago or so, about how to make China pay for COVID-19. I think the median American, kind of like a leitmotif of the show, we talk about how the median American is still kind of sober and reasonable enough to recognize that biological men competing in women's sports is crazy, that critical race theory and all the nonsense that Chris Rufo is digging up a daily basis, that all of this is kind of back crap insane. I do think the median American is able to kind of very just soberly survey the landscape, what has happened in the world over the past year and a half, bordering almost on 2 years now is where we enter the month of September, and say that China is uniquely culpable for what happened here. They are uniquely culpable for just the utter destruction in both human lives and economic damage and social fabrics and childhood development, children who have missed a year or two of school, Zoom, they will never get those years back. And the median American understands that China should pay. So to just put a little cherry on top of all of this, because I agree with everything that has been said here, the extent to which this IC report can be used to not punitively inflict damage on China, I'm not calling for war, obviously, but something short of that, that will, I think, only exacerbate this this chasm between the deplorables, all of us who see what we see very clearly, and a ruling class that is willfully blind to the reality on the ground.
Well, speaking of China, I'm going to transition to my segment, which is our greatest Chinese import, the social credit score, which we are increasingly seeing across corporate America. But I wanted to flag one. This is a theme I talk about a lot on this podcast, but I wanted to flag one new sort of recent example, which hasn't actually been confirmed. So it remains an allegation, but a fairly heavily substantiated one, which is that Chase Bank has now banned or canceled the account and the credit card of General Michael Flynn over the fact that having him as a client or as a customer would pose a, quote, reputational risk to the company. And so, you know, this is a theme that I've brought up many times, but it is, you know, major corporations, major gateways to capitalism in the United States, quite frankly, policing their users over ideology, right? Because here you have Michael Flynn, who hasn't ostensibly, there's been no evidence that he's violated Chase Bank's, you know, regulatory policy or user behavior, whatever it, you know, purports to say is its, you know, guidelines for its users. He's just been a person in the world, right? It's caught up in a political drama that I think largely has been mostly unfair. And because of that, he now can't access, you know, banking services. Now, this is just one of a number of examples that we've seen lately. I think I've talked about PayPal working with the Anti-Defamation League to police its users. And PayPal is the world's biggest non-bank lender. So if you are cut off from the banking system, you can't even use the alternatives, you know, for under whatever metric ADL now constitutes as hate speech or hate activities. It's unhelpfully not telling us what the criteria is, just whatever it decides. You know, so we've seen that. Obviously, one of the biggest examples was Donald Trump after January 6th, obviously wasn't just kicked off Facebook and Twitter, but was shut down. His banking services cut him off. His lawyers refused to work with him. His email provider dropped him. Credit card companies, processing companies like Stripe wouldn't work with his campaign. And, you know, we've also seen one-off examples away from just famous people. You know, leading up to the election, you saw MailChimp get very aggressive with like Northern Virginia Tea Party groups that were just trying to organize around the election. They were cut off. I have been subject to MailChimp censorship as well, just for sending out my columns about COVID-19. That was flagged as hateful behavior. So it's this theme again of corporate America getting into the ideological game, you know, and it goes against everything that we have always assumed about the market, right? We've always assumed that the profit motive would overcome the sort of overt politicking. And we're now seeing very clear examples of it not happening. And to me, it's the scariest in the banking services. Because again, you know, we see it, Michael Flynn, this isn't the first time Chase has done this. I've also seen it from JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, who will not process transactions for certain firearms. If you are a contractor that works with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, I think it's Wells and JP Morgan won't offer you depository services. To me, the banking services thing is a real problem because, again, this isn't just Facebook, right? This isn't just sharing pictures or advertising. This is how you access the market, right? This is getting a loan. This is having access to things that make this economy run. And so if we're going to put down ideological thresholds here, you know, we've talked about this at length before. I don't know what the answer is. And I think this is why I keep bringing it up, because I'm hopeful that the right will iterate on this question, because we don't have a good answer for it. Just today, right? You have the January 6th commission announcing that Democrats on that commission announcing that they are sending orders to 30 private companies, major telecom companies like Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, Apple, among others, to preserve geolocation records and the call records of members of Congress and people that were around on January 6th, because Democrats want access to them. And this information is protected by law. You know, you are not supposed to be able to just demand it without a warrant. And yet it is very possible that these companies will just hand over the records of their users to Democrats for obviously partisan reasons. And so we're in a situation where the right doesn't have an answer here. And I'm not sure, and they need one, but I'm not sure what it should be. I think if you can look at Congress and say, well, okay, we should stop privileging these companies. You know, we should strike their tax subsidies and, you know, all the other myriad ways in which our public policy privileges them. But how is it that, how do we grapple with how our assumptions about the market have failed here? It's not the profit motive that's compelling these companies. It's an overt political motive. And how is it that one, how does the right respond? But two, what does this portend, I guess, for us if we don't get it under control? I've said before, this is the only conclusion I see is two separate countries in one geographic location, and that's not America, frankly. So I kind of put it out to everybody else. I really struggle with how the right should have, right needs a response. I'm just not sure what a really compelling one is yet.
I'll just go because you just said that's not America. And I think that is the central premise that is a central problem, because I'm surprised that this has not been a problem for our country earlier when you think about it, because this is we are so fragile. Our system is so fragile, and it has worked because we had a shared consensus on how we operated businesses and how we operated on all of these different things that honestly the panopticon of social media is completely undoing, because you can scour the internet for what every person has ever said. You know this person's record from A to Z, and we have gotten completely intolerant. Sorry about that. That has made us completely intolerant of dissent, because it's so easy to prove, and we have this definition inflation that makes us call everybody else a bigot, evil, traitor, and we're so divided because of social media, we're so exposed because of social media, that this consensus is shattering, and that consensus is what held so much of the country together. It's shocking. Like, when you think about how fragile our system is, it is truly amazing to me that this is really becoming a problem right now. Do conservatives now have to start their own banks and banking services? Yeah, probably. That's a direction that we're actually headed in, because again, this is so fragile, and it's like a domino, right? Once the first domino topples, they're all going to start to fall. And that may seem hyperbolic and alarmist, but if we go at this rate, that's exactly where we're headed, and we're headed there really soon.
Yeah, the point of ideological segregation in the marketplace, I think, would be the natural end, but for the fact that, I mean, what do you all think? What are the odds that ultimately the conservative businesses get regulated out of existence using government power on whatever grounds, you know, national security and public health grounds, while the kind of woke businesses who have adhered to kind of the prevailing ideology on college campuses and beyond end up being the sole, you know, the incumbent businesses are the only ones that remain. And I think that gets to a point here, which as Rachel, you were talking about financial services in particular, financial services is one of the most highly regulated industries that there is. So it's interesting to note that in a really highly regulated industry like that, and of course, increasingly every industry is highly regulated, de facto or de jure, basically these companies are doing the bidding of the government. They are imposing the DC prevailing uniparty ideology. And if you make it that, to point to the January 6th, to tie to January 6th, that the MAGA portion of the country is terrorist or terrorist adjacent, then of course, all of these companies are going to put forth policies that discriminate against up to half the country. And going after General Flynn, this starts always with, you know, the fringe figures, the Alex Jones types of the world. And it obviously was never going to end with them. But the point is to send a chilling message to everyone: get in line with our ideology, or you are going to be excommunicated from society, smeared, punished, and beyond. Those January 6th document demand requests as well, there were several other ones, also, I think, point to this exact same point. And so what is the answer? The core answer ultimately is you have to change the prevailing ideology of the country, which goes back to something like neutrality. I don't think we're going there, but I think the left is forcing the kind of breakup, this crack up. And do we need to build our own internet and all that other infrastructure? That's one response, but is that doable? Is there a cheaper, more efficient, faster way to win the ideological war? I don't know. But increasingly, we are getting to the point where half the country is going to be canceled, or the threat of cancellation is going to be hung over their heads. And the first step, obviously, is recognizing how pervasive it is. And of course, our representatives clearly do not have the same fear that I think we all have. So there's the issue of our non-representative representatives. There's the issue of what are the prevailing ethoses among our people and our society. And then there's the tactical, like, what do you do given the problem set that we face? And I don't have that answer, but we ought to think deeply about it.
So when I look at this problem, which obviously has a lot of parallels to the problem that is big tech, the same way that the financial institutions are kind of cutting off your means to access basic ways of trading and taking out credit and leading a life, as so are the big tech platforms, of course, excommunicating us from the proverbial 21st century public square. I guess I see three basic paths forward here. They're not strictly mutually exclusive, but they probably partially are. One is the full black pill, the full black pill tape, which Rachel alluded to, which is this experiment is actually going to come to an end, and we are going to approach something closely approximating, if not actually being a civil war in our lifetime. The other two options are, and the second option was what Abraham Lincoln did, of course, which is full kind of non-liberal, very kind of overtly nationalistic, I'm not going to say authoritarian, but aggressive government rule for the common good in a way that preserves that quote more perfect union which the preamble speaks. As far as kind of big tech solutions, this is kind of getting into like common carrier regulation and things of that nature. So at least in the tech space, I think the second option is kind of gaining a lot of clout among conservatives. The third option, our friend Matt Peterson of Claremont American Mind talked about new tech, red states, new media, is kind of a much stronger form of federalism, which will only go so far, to be clear, unless we can like actually convince en masse a lot of these platforms to actually physically relocate to states like here in Florida or back in Texas where I used to live. That has a lot of problems in and of itself, obviously, because a lot of this regulation still the federal level comes top down from DC. So we're kind of getting into like the legal details there of like which level of our dual sovereignty system is actually regulating. But if we want to try to avoid the black pill take, then the possible solutions have to be in those two middle camps. And I'm not going to have like a perfect answer here in the final 30 seconds of this segment, obviously. But we probably should consider something along the lines of common carrier regulation for financial services if this actually gets to be that bad. I mean, if this problem truly exacerbates, and it's not a perfect analogy. The banks are simply, as a matter of like legal terminology, do not fit the common carrier legal category as neatly as the tech platforms do for a myriad reasons. But surely there are some sort of kind of like legally analogous solutions that we ought to consider here. But I do think in the short term, at least until kind of we on the right can figure out a better path forward, at least I can recommend, I think, adamantly two things. One is, let's train the next generation of conservatives to be able to use the levers of government power to preserve our people's way of life in the public square. Rachel and I are on the advisory board of American Moment. That group exists to basically do exactly that. And on the other hand, I'm speaking here personally, but come move to red states, come move to Florida and Texas. Let's build some kind of oasis here in Havens. But we're out of time for this segment. So let's transition to final thoughts. So does anyone want to start us off here?
Yeah, my last final thought on this is, I do think that this is one of the most pressing public policy problems for the right that we just don't have a coherent framework for, because I just want to emphasize, under the Democrats' theory of subpoena power under the January 6th Commission, not only could the government compel all this geolocation data, your call histories, but your medical records that Google has, or your web search history. So we have created, Emily refers to it as the panopticon, which I think is correct. We created this panopticon in the private sector that the government wants to visibly abuse. They want that information to, for lack of a better word, persecute you along ideological lines. And there is no public policy framework around that. So anyone who's listening to this, who's a younger generation conservative, kind of thinking of a public policy career, this would be a great place to start. So that's my final thought.
I don't have a whole lot to add, because I feel like we've covered a lot in this episode already. But just to kind of circle back to Afghanistan here, I don't feel the need to spend any more airtime talking about just the epic layer upon layer of the ways in which this was botched. The refugee crisis, I truly, genuinely fear, is going to be something that is going to pay seriously negative dividends for us over the next few years. I genuinely pray that I'm wrong about that. But anyone who has surveyed just kind of the way that the U.S. government has messed up time and time again here, from the generals to the IC, to the foreign policy establishment, to purport then to then have some sort of confidence that we are, quote unquote, vetting these people, that all of them are the right kind of people, that were translator interpreters. I mean, that sentiment is just simply completely detached and divorced from reality. We are undoubtedly going to be bringing in a lot of people who we should not be bringing in. Obviously, Europe, Germany, perhaps more than any other country, did this in the middle of the last decade. And you know, that crime rates dramatically escalated in Germany, France, a lot of these countries that brought in, you know, a largely Syrian, some Turkish, and other folks from the Levant area. Crime rates just dramatically escalated here. And what's horrifying is that, of course, on the domestic front, America has already been experiencing a dramatic upsurge in violent crime since the George Floyd 1619 riots started over a year ago now. So we're really at a time of just great national grieving in many ways, and we're at in a lot of major cities with the homelessness epidemics across a lot of these urban areas, where people are just quite literally afraid to step out of their doors. We are willfully, by our own choice, by our own volition, bringing in a problem that is just taking a tinderbox and lighting potentially a blowtorch to it. So maybe I'm being a little hyperbolic here, because the sheer number of Afghans we're bringing in, I guess in the grand scheme of things, in the grand scheme of our kind of million a year immigration system, is comparatively modest. But I really, really, really do fear as to what is actually going to happen 3 years from now, looking back on this decision. And I don't think it will reflect well on the elites of both parties who've been pushing for it.
Well, let me pick up on that point, because what scares me isn't just this. It's also how that the same ideology that is could put us in trouble in terms of an influx of people that are difficult to vet. Our bureaucracy has already proven itself to be incapable of really doing an efficient job of undertaking that vetting process. This is happening on our southern border every single day. We literally do not know of who is crossing the border. In some cases, of course, we do, but we do not track it as well as we should. We are not as safe as we should be in terms of monitoring the people who are coming in and out and pouring through that porous border. And the reason that both of these things, which our country should be able to do efficiently and should be able to use our taxpayer dollars to do efficiently, the reason that it can't do it is because it is completely hampered by this ideology, right? Because this ideology guides it into these extremely dangerous directions that puts our government, our military, in a situation where it doesn't serve the people that funds it and that put their trust in it to serve them. That's why the like America First line has so much power. It's because people are saying, like, listen, I'm paying for the services to vet the border. I'm paying for the services to vet refugees, because this is a country that should be able to be a safe haven for people who are refugees, for our allies. This is a country that people should be able to find greater prosperity in. But you can't do that effectively. You can't secure the border. I'm paying so much money. You can't even do that because you're so hampered and you're so prevented by this notion that we need to, you know, the whatever your concept of equity is, whatever, you can't do anything without running afoul of the governing ideology. And that prevents our efficiency, or it hampers our efficiency, and it prevents our government from doing its job. So that's to just pick up on Josh's point. I think our fears are so much deeper. And on that issue, it's a good example of how that can apply across our institutions and the duties that our government and our institutions are supposed to perform.
It's also worth noting here that, well, first of all, in Afghanistan itself, you saw wokeism crash into the most unwoke or anti-woke kind of culture possible, a tribal, largely Sharia-based culture. And incidentally, we helped Afghanistan draft a constitution subordinate to Islam in the letter of the constitution that we drafted itself. And Sharia is widely, like over 90% supported, if you look at polls by the population there, the antithesis of what a woke culture would look like or what a woke government would look like. And yet, of course, first of all, we tried to impose our system on the unwoke and it obviously failed. Now we're trying to import people who come from one of the most unwoke possible cultures and expecting there to be a happy resolution to that. Just shows you once again the insanity of a ruling class. And then also our ruling class does everything it can to emulate communist China, our social credit system with deep state characteristics currently being implemented, being one representation of this. And yet communist China itself, another one of the least woke places in the world, of course, persecuting Uyghur Muslims, Tibetans, Hong Kongers, Taiwanese, they threaten, Falun Gong and all manner of other minorities as well. Christians, massive Christian population there persecuted to an unbelievable extent. So isn't it fascinating that our ruling class, our woke ruling class, seeks to emulate or try to make common cause with the most unwoke? And I think to tie it back to January 6th, what it shows is that wokeism is really a fraud. It's a means to an end of power ultimately, and it tries to give a socially just and virtuous veneer to what really at core is a fascistic or totalitarian sort of system in which our elites want to cement themselves as elites and subjugate other people to their rule. And January 6th, to point to the chilling, really totalitarian nature of our elites, if you look at these document demands, and maybe we'll talk about it in next week's episode, there have been, I think, three document demands, and I hadn't even seen yet the requests of the telecom companies, but I know it had been threatened already that there might even be subpoenas for the phone records of members of Congress. But there were two other document requests, one to big tech companies asking for all manner of information about posts that were flagged as misinformation and the like relating to the election. And there was another massive document demand asking for all sorts of the deepest questions that the Trump administration might have grappled with around, you know, how do you plan on litigating the election? And who are the people that you talk to about the election? And naming conservative activists and commentators by name and asking for all communications between the administration and these people. And what is all of this about? It's not only a fishing expedition, but it's about instilling fear in the public. Anyone who dares not submit to the official ruling class narrative. At the end of the day, that is what this is about. That's why, as I wrote for Josh in Newsweek, that this would resemble more a wrongthink inquisition than a January 6th commission. I think those fears are being realized in real time. And we ought to call out this totalitarianism when we see it and call wokeism the fraud that it is, the means to the end of power.
Well, with that, I think we'll bring this episode to a close. On behalf of Emily, Ben, Josh, and myself, I'm Rachel Bovard. This is NatCon Squad. We'll see you next time.